Okay, we're going to continue with the Doctrine of Providence, Chapter 5, Confession of Faith, Chapter 5. We want to look at Section 5. And this has to do with the providence of God, particularly with respect to the sins of the people of God. How is it, with what we've affirmed concerning providence, that we can now talk about, and in fact we've affirmed concerning sin, that we can talk about this in terms of the children of God. And the answer is that A lot of the way we look at things is wrong if we begin with ourselves. When we consider the question of sin, and really to a certain degree we're talking about the problem of evil here, but evil in a particular context, that is in the context of sinning, how it is that God, in fact, interweaves the bad, the evil, the sin, with his children in particular. We're concerned about that in this section. If we begin with the doctrine of God, if we think about the way God has told us that he's acting on our behalf, we need to understand that from the very beginning, that God's action, and to the extent that there's co-action, which we talked about before, in the providence of God concerning sin, that his action and co-action in that sin is all for good. That the sinfulness of that sin is coming from us. And so that ultimately the issue is this. Can God overrule not only the action, but in a sense, what we're concerned with it here is how God in his providence is dealing with that sinfulness of the action as it comes from us. Is that entirely outside of his control? This section of the confession is telling us no. In fact, God is going to use that filth that is being spewed out of his people. He's going to use it in such a way that ultimately it will conduce to their good. He'll use it to chasten them. He'll use it to sanctify them. He'll use it to drive them on to higher and higher spiritual good. So that even that the emanation of that sinfulness that attends to the sinful action of man, what we're going to say in this section is, even that God is overruling. That's really the point of this section. That even that part of it, you know, we can't even say that that part of it escapes the providence of God. You know, even that, for the children of God in particular, even that God will use for the good of the creature and for his own glory. Now that brings us to section 5. The most wise, righteous, and gracious God doth oftentimes leave for a season his own children to manifold temptations, and the corruption of their own hearts, to chastise them for their former sins, or to discover unto them the hidden strength of corruption and deceitfulness of their hearts, that they may be humbled, and to raise them to a more close and constant dependence for their support upon himself, and to make them more watchful against all future occasions of sin, and for sundry other just and holy ends. You see, the Westminster Divines are very concerned that we begin this question really with an eye to the end of it all. If we understand that all of this is being turned to the glory of God and to the good of his people, then we can begin to speak to this in a much more intelligible way. If we view sin as wholly undoing, well then, it really doesn't even serve a purpose in believers. And this is not an encouragement, not meant to be an encouragement for us to sin, by the way. This is a statement that is designed to bring comfort to believers, to let them know that their sins can be turned around and sanctified in the end. That there is something positive that can come out of it if we believe. You know, if you're an unbeliever, forget it. There's not going to be a good issue here. If you're turned aside and you're going to pursue a sinful course, it's not going to end well. But for believers, for those who have, as believers, sinned, which is all of us, this is sort of the silver lining in that cloud. They're not saying that you're going to escape every temporal consequence. They're not saying that it's going to be smooth sailing if you pursue this route. But if the ends are achieved, that is, if we're humbled by it, if we're raised to a consciousness of needing more support, that we're more dependent upon God, if we're made more watchful by it, then it hasn't been in vain. You know, it is only in vain when we fail to improve it. And that is when God does not improve it in us. He's only going to improve it in those who are his people. Again, that's part of the underlying theme in this section. So, the first question, and it has to do with temptation. Question one, does God ever seduce a man to commit sin? And the answer is no. God does not solicit or seduce any man to sin, for this is inconsistent with the purity of his nature. We want to look at James 1, 13 and 14.
James 1, verses 13 and 14. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed.
And we've talked about the idea of temptation and that all that it really connotes is the idea of a trial. And that the trial could go either way. But temptation in the Bible generally tends to issue in a very bad outcome. At least that's the way we tend to think of it. And that, in fact, when we fall by reason of a temptation, that's in fact what is usually the outcome is. It's evil. It's not simply a trial. It's not being considered simply as a trial that is sort of a neutral to see whether there's going to be good or bad coming out of it. It really respects the kind of trial that you, if you fail, it's going to be bad. It'll be a bad thing. God isn't soliciting or seducing men to sin. It's not part of the nature of God. He doesn't do that. And in fact, if we understand that the real negative in all temptation arises not from the occasion that is God juxtaposing a meeting of persons or a person and an event. You know, temptation generally occurs when an agent meets an occasion. And that can happen in any number of ways. We know that God is the one who is superintending that. But properly speaking, what makes it a temptation? That is, what makes it an occasion of evil? And the answer is, it's not God. What makes it an occasion of evil is our own native depravity. We're the ones who are going to turn a situation that could be good or perhaps not. We're going to turn it to ill. And when Herod was informed by the Magi of the birth of Christ, it could have been good, right? It could have turned into a good thing. Instead, it becomes a murderous rampage. What was the cause of that? Well, the immediate cause of that is Herod's sinful nature. God brings about this crossing of paths, exchange of information. It's all controlled by the providence of God. It's all been predestined. But the sinfulness, the wickedness that results from that, that arises, James says, purely from the heart of man. And that's right. Because it's impossible that anything would arise from God that would be contrary to God. He can't deny himself. You know, there's no shadow of turning in him. Now, it's more understandable for us, I think, as we discuss man in terms of the fall. And we're going to be presuming that a lot here. We'll talk about the fall directly in the next chapter. But Scripture asserts that the reprobate are delivered up to depraved lust. Is it because the Lord depraves or corrupts their hearts? And the reason is no, it's by no means. The fact is, their hearts are subjected to depraved lust because they are already corrupt and vicious. And this is what is alluded to in Matthew 15, 18 and Mark 7, 21 and 22.
Matthew 15, verse 18. But those things which proceed out of the mouth come forth from the man, and they defile. But those things which proceed out of the mouth come forth from the heart, and they defile the man.
Mark 7, verses 21 and 22. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness.
Man's heart is depraved by reason of sin. And because they're depraved, the lust, the desire of the heart, is wholly contrary to God. We ought not be surprised, then, that given an occasion, the outcome is going to be evil in a temptation. An agent brought into proximity to that occasion is going to do evil. In fact, if God didn't restrain them, men would do only evil. The fact that we see any good is a demonstration of the fact the Spirit of God is restraining the wicked from doing all of their designs. That's what the psalmist tells us. God has set restraining bounds on their activity. They can't do all the dirty deeds that they would like to do. All the nasty things that they want to do to one another.
What psalm is that?
Psalm 76. So, God uses all of that. He conducts it all. He turns it all to his own glory and to the good of his church, his people. More importantly, for our point here, as we'll see, he also turns even that in his people to their good and his glory. But because of this, because of the link between the heart and the desires, the scripture is very clear. Men are warned to keep their hearts in Proverbs 4:23.
Proverbs 4, verse 23. Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life.
Now, we see that, however, since God blinds or hardens, shouldn't we say then that he's the author or minister of evil? The answer is no. Again, in this manner he punishes sin, and he renders a just reward to the ungodly who refuse to be ruled by his Spirit. For example,
Romans 1:26. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, even their women, to change the natural use into that which is against nature.
And it follows from that that the origin of sin is not in God. No blame can be imputed to him as though he took pleasure in evils. Genesis 6:6.
And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and he grieved him at his heart.
And God is not taking pleasure in this. It's not pleasurable. That is to say, the sinfulness of the sin does not fall out by his good pleasure. We talk about the permissibility of sin. Now, the permissibility of that sin is made to subserve his good pleasure. But sin by its very nature is any want of conformity unto or transgression of the law of God. And that means that sin cannot be found in God. Why? Well, he's not himself subject to the moral law. He decrees it, and in some sense it reflects something of the nature of the deity toward the man, the creature. But there is a higher righteousness in God. And by and through that higher righteousness, nothing can come to pass contrary to his will of decree. So that from the point of view of the deity, from God's point of view, there is no possibility of anything happening contrary to his own will. So nothing can be described as being sinful, because nothing is being done from a motive other than this. God worketh all things after the counsel of his own good pleasure and for his own glory. The creature can't make the same claim. And because he can't, it is not only possible, it has happened, that sin has arisen in the creature, in and through the creature. You know, the issue ultimately is that the creature is not performing in the way that God, A, has commanded him, nor B, is he acting from the motive of seeking both the glory of God and his own good. How do we know this? Well, again, because God has said for his own glory, if you love me, you'll keep my law. God has said for his own glory, you shall obey. Choose you this day. Man, for his own good, has been told, choose life. Choose the keeping of the law. Choose the obedience. So man can't, when he disobeys that, can't ever plead either the glory of God or even his own good. And that's why it's sin. You can get caught up in all kinds of other discussions, but what really makes it sin is that it does not comport with the glory of God as man has been commanded to glorify God, nor does it redound to the good of the man as man has been told by God to seek his own good. That makes it sin and sin. Right? God is not able to be the author of sin because there can be no contrariety in God. He's not willing something contrary to his own good or his own glory. Nor is it possible for God to be the approver of sin because he, being all good, has told the creature what most redounds to his glory and comports with the creature's own good. The creature by sin breaks the link between God's glory and his own good. In other words, God will still get his glory. He will always be glorified. He's going to be glorified in the salvation of the elect and in the damnation of the reprobate. But only in the salvation of the elect will the good of the creature be conserved. It's sin that breaks the link between the glory of God and the good of the agent acting. And God can never be that. He can never be the author, nor can he be the approver of that. So, the fact is, though, he does punish sin and renders a just reward to the ungodly who refuse to be ruled. And he doesn't take pleasure in that sin. That sin exists, as I said, theologically we talk about the permission to sin or the permission of evil. Because that which is permitted is subordinate to his good pleasure. It must serve his good pleasure, and it will. But it is not, in fact, going to redound to the good of the creature. But no creature is going to be able to say on Judgment Day, well, you didn't tell me what to do. God said, choose life. And by the way, here's what that means. You must do this, 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 and this. This is the way you need to glorify me. If you want it to be glorifying me and make it conducive to your own good. Remember the first question in our catechism. What is the chief end of man? Man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Sin knocks out that end. You're going to glorify God. Everybody's going to glorify God. The only question is, are you going to join with that and enjoy forever? Is that going to be the other part of your purpose in life? You know, those people who are suffering eternal damnation are not enjoying him forever. And so they're not going to, they're not living forever to their chief or highest end. But that does not detract from the glory of God, because God's glory is neither augmented nor diminished by what we do or what we are. He is wholly sufficient, and his glory is wholly sufficient in and of itself. All right. Preliminary matters out of the way. Let's move into question two. Question two. Does not God, in righteous judgment, permit men to be both tempted and to fall into sin as just punishment for former sins? Notice the language of permission again. And the answer is yes. All right. God, in righteous judgment, sometimes permits persons to fall into one sin for the punishment of another. We see that borne out in Romans 1:27.
Romans 1:27, and likewise also men leaving the natural use of a woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men working that which is unseemly, receiving in themselves that recompense of the error which was meet.
Yeah, the error of which was meet or fitted. Now God is punishing sin with sin. This is why men join wickedness to wickedness, and evil to evil, and sin to sin. Generally speaking, people are moving in one direction or the other. They're not static. They're either moving forward in sanctification, or they spend their lives degrading into greater and greater evil. Blasphemy, idolatry, every kind of other, every other kind of spiritual wickedness that they can commit, and very often it's joined with all kinds of sins against the second table of the law as well. That's God's righteous judgment to punish sin with sin, and so in his providence he permits. And again, the language of permission is language that is used to indicate that the glory of God in those instances is separate, severable from the good of the creature. That's one thing signified by the language of permission. Another thing signified is that that which exists by the permission of God is something which arises and emanates through secondary causality. It particularly is language that has to do with sin. There is a permission here, because in the sinfulness of sin, that desirable end of the glory of God and the good of man, that's been severed. And the only reason for severing that in the providence of God, that is for submerging this permission, which is not a bare permission, as we saw, submerging it into the good pleasure of God. The only reason for that is that God is seeking to be glorified in ways not only that redound to the good of the creature, but in ways that do not redound to the good of the creature. And that's God's higher righteousness. All right, he deals in this way, in fact, even with his own dear but undutiful children. 1 Chronicles 21, we want to look at 1 to 4, excuse me.
1 Chronicles 21, 1 to 4. And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel. And David said to Joab and to the rulers of the people, go number Israel from Beersheba even to Dan, and bring the number of them to me that I may know it. And Joab answered, the Lord make his people 100 times so many more as they be. But my lord the king, are not they Are they not all my Lord's servants? Why then does my Lord require this thing? Who will he be a cause? Why will he be a cause of trespass to Israel? Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. Wherefore, Joab departed and went throughout all Israel and came to Jerusalem.
The point of this section, again, is to deal with the question of sin, particularly in the children of God. And it's very clear that God permits a man to be both tempted and to fall into sin as punishment for former sin. In other words, here David, he's given warning, he's given opportunity even to evade, as all of God's children are. We're told what's right and wrong. We're told what God requires, what duty he requires of us. It's been declared to us. You know, it's been declared to David. And yet, there's an undutifulness. You know, kings were not permitted to stand up and do all of this. See, he already knew that. He shouldn't have needed additional counsel in this regard. But he gets it. There's an undutifulness in that. Not only is the word of God told him, don't do this, don't number the people, he's also neglected the counsel, godly counsel, that was given him. There's an undutifulness in that. And God very often will then permit temptation and fall into sin, even of his own children, when they behave in this way. Remember, Proverbs says, in the multitude of counselors there's safety. And when we go off trying to do things on our own, when we don't take counsel of others, particularly others who are godly and exercised in perhaps whatever matter is under consideration, that not only shows a lack of wisdom, but there's an undutifulness in it. You're not doing what you ought to do. Remember, duty is tied to the word due. It's a rendering of what is due. You're not rendering what is due when you ignore the law of God, and then when you take counsel, or fail to take counsel from the godly, or worse, if you take counsel from the wicked. Sometimes we know he leads them for a season to temptations, to the lusts of their own hearts, for their trial, or to discover themselves, discover to themselves the latent corruptions of their hearts, to humble them, and to excite them to more fervent prayer and unremitting watchfulness. Matthew 26:41.
Matthew 26:41. Watch and pray that ye enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.
The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. God, by allowing his children to fall into this, he's letting them know. He's letting them discover. You see, forget for a moment the sinfulness of the sin, but the fall into the sin, the temptation and fall into the sin. If the end result is that you come to know your own corruption, that's a win for sanctification. That's actually for your good. It's for the good of the creature, ultimately. It's drawing you out of the mire and the muck. That's God using what is at best a crooked stick to hit the ball straight. We're commanded that we're not to do evil that good may come. But God can turn every evil, even the worst, into good. And he does that again and again in the hearts and lives of his children. He turns it again and again. And what he's doing each time he does that, remember, evil and sin is a propensity to return to nothingness, because we're nothing without God. God, by doing that, God is, in fact, bringing good, bringing something out of nothing. There is a creation, a recreation. There's a renewal. God isn't dependent, like we are, on pre-existing stuff in order to make something, particularly something good. We see the case of Hezekiah. God left Hezekiah to try him, that he might know or make known all that was in his heart. 2 Chronicles 32, 25, 26, and 31.
2 Chronicles 32, verses 25 and 26. Hezekiah rendered not again according to the benefit done unto him, for his heart was lifted up. Therefore there was wrath upon him and upon Judah and Jerusalem. Notwithstanding, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Lord came not upon them in the days of Hezekiah. And verse 31, howbeit in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart.
God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart. It's not a question of whether or not God knows. God knows. God does know. God is fully aware of how corrupt the hearts of all men are, especially his people. But when he leaves his own children to these manifold temptations, there is, in fact, a discovery that is made possible. He's able to make known through that not only the corruption of the heart, but very often the depth of the corruption. A lot of times, you know, we don't think that we're as bad as we are. Especially, you know, church people. Church people tend to start thinking we're better than we really are. We tend to think that, you know, I'm certainly not as bad as the other guy. After all, I worship God. You know, big plus in my column. But the fact is, we have the same kind of corrupt hearts as anyone else. And there's this matter of indwelling sin. And there's this very real possibility of deceitfulness creeping in, where we become complacent. We start to think we're bulletproof. We aren't going to be able to be assaulted. There's, you know, God's put a hedge about me, and I'm just not like other men. I'm not sinful like other men. Sometimes God strips all that away so that you can sin, so you can be made aware, painfully aware, that you are like other men. And that's precisely why you stand in need of redemption like other men. You know, we should never think that there's something that we've done, somehow that we've merited the grace of God, that we're doing something, we're doing pretty well. Again, especially, you know, we're keeping up with the Joneses, and we're, spiritually speaking, we're constantly doing a little bit better than the other guy. Doesn't matter. Really doesn't matter. God is in full control. And even the wrath of man will be made to praise him. You know, not only the wrath of man as they are reprobate, but even the elect have that remnant of wrath, that screaming, cursing at God in them. You know, until we're taken out of this world, we have indwelling sin. And we're involved in this process of mortifying indwelling sin. This is designed to bring you to a realization. This is designed to make you know. So God does this. He punishes sin with sin. And whether it's spiritual pride or a lack of dutifulness, which includes a failure to be watchful or prayerful about these things, whatever the cause, that sin, and it's provoking sin. It's the kind of sin that invites God. You're saying to God, well, you know, maybe I need to be taught a lesson again about how wicked I am. And that's never a good thing, that we bring ourselves to that. And yet, what is never a good thing, God is able to make into a good thing. So while we're not to sin, the grace may abound, we should be assured that where there is sin, grace does abound. And that's the point here. Sometimes God deals in this manner with his own children to chastise them for their former sins, such as in 2 Samuel 24:1.
2 Samuel 24, verse 1. And again the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go, number Israel and Judah.
Go, number Israel and Judah. Why? Well, he's mad. God is angry with him. He's chastising them. He's looking for that occasion. You know, what provides the occasion? Well, there are plenty of sinners that are going to give you occasion. Just bring the agent into close proximity to the event. And if there's no restraint, if the Spirit of God doesn't restrain, all bets are off. You know, in fact, all bets should be on, because the fact is you're going to choose evil. The only thing is that, as we've said before, God will choose the channel in which your evil will flow. He will choose the course, and he will choose the punishment that then will correspond to that course. So God is providentially overseeing all of this. Again, yet without sin. The sinfulness of all of this is wholly on our part. And in the case of his own children, he's making all of this to redound not only to his own glory, which he always does, but also to their own good, which he only does for the elect. That's a matter of grace. If your sin somehow redounds to your good, it's the grace of God. You should never be counting on that going into sinning. All right, third question. Doesn't God often leave his children under manifold temptations to raise them to a more close and constant dependence for their support upon himself? Well, yeah, that's exactly another point that they bring up here. There is the issue of the corruption of our own hearts, or chastising for former sin. But there's also this issue. One aspect of sin is this. Men tend to view themselves as independent. And there is a lot of that, I think, even amongst people who profess to be Christians. They they really begin to sort of think that they have their God armor on, and that's all they need. It's sort of them and God. They're driving God the way they need to drive God when they need to drive Him. They forget that they're utterly dependent. It's very easy for men, particularly when things go well, it's very easy for men to forget how utterly dependent they are upon Him. You know, when all things are going well, when it's an easy course in front of you, the temptations are much greater to forget God. If you're not more forward in your thankfulness, you are going to be provoking God in this very way, to remove His hand, to leave you to more temptations, so that you will find yourself lying in the mud somewhere, looking up and saying, "What happened? I guess I need more grace. I guess I need more divine assistance. I should have been more prayerful. I should have been more watchful. I should have been more careful. I should have been more aware of my utter dependence." That's why Paul was given a thorn in the flesh to draw him out of himself and his own strength to a greater dependence on God. 2 Corinthians 12:7-9.
2 Corinthians 12:7-9. "Unless I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me."
Yeah, interestingly enough, Paul here calls this thorn in the flesh the messenger of Satan. And he does on this ground, that all temptations are sent by Satan, that is, as they are designed to our undoing. Now, God is not the one seeking to undo. If we read in Job 1 and 2, remember, it's Satan who's doing. God is granting that permission. But Satan is the one who's looking to undo Job. God is trying Job. He's tempting Job in the sense that he's trying him. But he's trying him because he knows the end from the beginning. He knows that Job will come through in the end. And even the sinfulness that bubbles up in the end of it all is going to be turned not only to the glory of God, but to the good of Job. So, as these are things meant to destroy you, to break that connection between God's glory and your good, they are temptations that are sent by Satan. And whenever they assail us, they're warnings to us. Satan is at hand. 1 Chronicles 21:1 again.
1 Chronicles 21:1, "And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel."
Yeah, when we're tempted to do what's evil, whether you know it or not, whether you're aware of it or not, when you're tempted to do what's wrong, when you're tempted to cut a corner morally, you should know that Satan or one of his minions is right there egging you on. You're not in it alone. Now, these temptations, although they take hold and they are in fact made effectual because of our corruption, our natural corruption, the fact is that the very fact that you are in this situation is evidence that Satan is here. This is, in fact, why the early church was so adamant about certain kinds of things like theater attendance. Now, why? It's a theater. It's a stage filled with temptation. You don't even have to ask any more questions. right? You know that Satan is at hand in all of this. There's a reason for this. It's meant to get your attention. It's meant to draw you in a direction. Oh yes, you have that tinderbox that is the dry stubble of your own wicked heart. And you've got the agency of men pouring oil on that dry wood. And you've got that fire burning and ready to burst forth. And then to put yourself in proximity to temptation deliberately is to bring yourself into the company and in the presence of the devil himself. Bow down and say hello to the master of your destiny if you're going to put yourself in his hands. You know, because he is the God of this world. If you don't resist him, he's going to have the mastery of you. So in every temptation, that's why Paul calls this thorn in the flesh, it's sent by Satan. It's a package addressed to him, but on the return address it says, devil, hell. And that's how we should see every temptation that comes our way. Not far behind the messenger is the one who sent the message. Right, hence then at every apprehension of temptation, it becomes us to arouse ourselves and arm ourselves with promptitude for repelling Satan's assaults. Ephesians 6:11.
Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil.
Again, we've talked about this before, the wiles of the devil, the fact that Satan is wily, that he's crafty, that he's cunning. You know, you're not nearly as smart as you think you are. You don't really have half the mastery of the things of this world that you think you have. And you certainly don't have the self-control you think you do, especially when you're not merely careless or neglectful in being watchful. But moreover, when it turns out that you yourself are going to propel yourself into the company of his most satanic majesty. It was most profitable then for Paul to think of this, because this consideration did not allow him to exult like a man that was off his guard.
Ephesians 4:22. That you put off concerning the former conversation and the old man, which is corrupt according to the deceitful lusts.
What is Paul concerned about here? Paul's concerned that he does not begin to think himself independent of God. To think that, you know, I've reached this point in my Christian walk, my sanctification. I become such a good person. I become so stable on my own here. Certainly, again, when I compare myself to everybody else in the neighborhood, particularly the ecclesiastical neighborhood, I'm okay. If I'm okay, you're okay, we're all okay, everything is looking good. Certainly, Paul could have followed modern pop psychology, followed the modern moralistic prescriptions that are handed out in most churches, and said, I'm doing much better than most. And yet, he sees this for what it is. That God is sending this to him, not necessarily in Paul's case to discover corruption in his heart, although he almost certainly did. But Paul sees it primarily as something that is going to keep him humble before God and with a sense of utter dependence upon the divinity. And Paul rejoices in that. Paul finds great comfort in that. And for Paul, that's not a bad thing. And notice if in each of these cases, if we make a right use of this, we will not only see that it was for the glory of God, but we will see it was for our own good. We'll see the goodness of God even in permitting that temptation. We'll see the goodness of God in keeping us under his hand in that way. Remember what Calvin said and very often says about this world. That if this world were a world of perfection, we really wouldn't long for glory. We wouldn't have any reason to want to leave very quickly. Paul sees this messenger of Satan, this thorn in the flesh. And he says, look, I understand even more why I need this close dependence upon God. This constant dependence upon God. This world is a minefield. It's a battleground. If everything was peace and plenty, it was all good. You know, one of the most frustrating things I think I ever hear people say is when they just say it's all good. It's not all good. If you think it's all good, you're not paying attention. It's not meant to be all good. You know, God, for his people, is using the wickedness, the sin, even your own sin, to bring about your own good. But if you think that all of this is all good, what you're telling me is you have no moral compass, and you have no sense of right and wrong, and you have no sense of good and evil. You know, when bad things are happening, you can't tell the difference between a bad thing and a good thing. God removes his hand, lets his people fall into manifold temptations, so that at the end of it all, they are in fact inclined to a closer walk, a closer dependence, a constant dependence. Right, also we look at David's meditation on the temptation before him, and that serves to bring him into a more intimate communion with the Lord. I want to look at all Psalm 73.
Psalm 73, truly God is good to Israel, even to such as are of a clean heart. But as for me, my feet were almost gone, my steps had well nigh slipped. For I was envious of the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no bands in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued as other men. Therefore pride compasseth them about a chain, violence covereth them as a garment. Their eyes stand out with fatness, they have more than heart could wish. They are corrupt and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue walketh through the earth. Therefore his people return hither, and waters of a full cup are wrung out to them. And they say, how doth God know, and is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the ungodly who prosper in the world. They increase in riches. Verily I have cleansed my heart in vain, and washed my hands in innocency. For all the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning. If I say, I will speak thus, behold, I should offend against the generation of thy children. When I thought to know this, it was too painful for me, until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then understood I therein. Surely thou didst set them in slippery places. Thou castest them down into destruction. How are they brought into desolation, as in a moment? They are utterly consumed with terrors. As a dream when one awaketh, so, O Lord, when thou awakest, thou shalt despise their image. Thus my heart was grieved, and I was pricked in my reins. So foolish was I and ignorant, I was as a beast before thee. Nevertheless, I am continually with thee. Thou hast holden me by my right hand. Thou shalt guide me with thy counsel, and afterward receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but thee, and there is none upon earth that I desire beside thee. My flesh and my heart faileth, but God is the strength of my heart, and my fortress forever. For lo, they that are far from thee shall perish. Thou hast destroyed all them that go a-whoring from thee. But it is good for me to draw near to God. I have put my trust in the Lord God, that I may declare all thy works.
David, the psalmist in this case, is meditating upon all of the temptations, right? Why, and this is a very interesting thing, why is it at one level, why is he tempted by this? When I saw the prosperity of the wicked, you know, God's good providence toward them shouldn't be an occasion to tempt him, and yet it is. It's drawing out that filth, that scum, that envy. He's envious. A godly man, he's envious when he sees the prosperity of the wicked. You know, he looks at them, he sees there no bands in their death, that is, there's no strength in it. It seems like they die and they have an easy time of it all. Everything seems to go well for them. It's a very similar complaint to the arguments you hear with Job's friends. They expected to see God's judgments. If God is just and he's good and he's this and he's that, we should see it. Why don't I see all of this? What's the problem here? So the temptation arises. Even good men are tempted by this. They look around and they see this. Good men are tempted by this. It's something that irks them. They find it irksome. It gets under their skin. Good men want to see justice, want to see the just judgment of God on the wicked. And when they don't, they throw up their hands and they say, why? What is this? In fact, the psalmist says, my foot, what? He said, it well nigh slipped. He said, I almost fell. This temptation got such a hold on me. But instead, what does he do? He turns this. It all turns. The temptation turns. Because he goes into the house of God, and he says, then I understood their end. He wasn't concerned then to look at what was going on outwardly. He no longer focused on the outward aspect of providence, but he looked to that inward motion of providence, which we're going to be talking about in a couple of weeks. The last couple of sections of this chapter have some interesting things to say about providence, particularly as it respects the church. He sees this. He understands from this. He says, I got understanding. And through understanding, he was no longer envious. He was no longer in danger of falling. He, in fact, was moved back to a dependence upon God. You know, if we focus too much on the outward world, our dependence moves. If our treasure is in this world, our hearts are going to be as well. If ultimately our concern is heaven and the glory of God, then our hearts are going to be there as well. And the psalmist ultimately has to come to this, that he, in fact, is more concerned about the glory of God than he is about this passing prosperity of the wicked. He no longer is going to allow this to be an occasion of his fall, temptation and fall. Rather, he's going to allow this to be an occasion of showing forth a greater concern for the glory of God. A greater appreciation and wedding of himself as a dependent upon God's mercy. Now, this could have gone a couple of different ways, but for God's people, ultimately, this is the point. These temptations ultimately should issue in not only the glory of God, but also the good of the creature. And they do. For the elect, all things work together for good to those who are the called of God, those that he loves, those who are called according to his purpose. Those are the ones for whom all things work together for good. It's not going to happen that way for the reprobate. But if you're a believer, you should take great comfort in this. You have every reason to take great comfort in this. You know, you should see in this that God will subdue even your sinful proclivities are going to be subdued to the glory of God and to your own good. And it will be your good. If finally, at the end of it all, you realize you need to depend upon God more, That's going to be to your good. That's going to be to his glory, and it's going to be to your good. But the psalmist gives evidence that the tempting of any of God's children ought to end in the greater glory being given to God. Psalm 77, verses 1, 10, and 12.
Psalm 77, verse 1. I cried unto God with my voice, he answered God with my voice, and he gave ear unto me. Verse 10. And I said, this is my infirmity, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. And verse 12. I will meditate also of all thy work, and talk of thy doings.
What is the point of it all? Well, again, the glory of God. It could have been that God left his people to fall totally and finally. But we're not Arminians. We're not Pelagians. We're not questioning. In fact, in a few more chapters, we'll be defending the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints. And that doctrine is wholly dependent upon this understanding that God will not totally and finally leave his people. In fact, that even their sins will be turned to his glory and their good. So whether it's a discovery of innate corruption or this idea that they need to be dependent upon him alone, whatever we learn from that, whatever we come to understand as a result of that temptation, that is, in fact, bringing light out of darkness, bringing something out of nothing, bringing good out of evil. And that's what God is doing when he brings our spiritual good out of our spiritual evil. And yet that's the whole point of this, and why I think we should pay closer attention. People who teach that, you know, once you've been saved, that you never sin again, that you only make mistakes and all that, they're missing the entire point here. One of the great mysteries of recreation, of redemption and regeneration is that God, for his elect, he's bringing light out of darkness and good out of evil. That he's able to turn all of that. All right, question four. Doth not God's leaving of his children to manifold temptations and even falls into sin have for their end to make them more watchful against all future occasions into which they might be ensnared? And the answer is yes. We see this in the case of Peter. His temptation and fall into sin had that very effect of making him more jealous to keep the precepts of his Lord. I want to compare Mark 14, 66 to 72 with John 21, 15 to 17.
Mark 14:66-72. And as Peter was beneath in the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, and thou also wast with Jesus of Nazareth. But he denied, saying, I know not, neither understand I what thou sayest. And he went out into the porch and the cottage. And a maid saw him again and began to say to them that stood by that it is one of them. And he denied it again, and a little after, they that stood by and said again to Peter, surely thou art one of them, for thou art of thy land. And they, and thy speech agreeth thereto. And he began to curse and to swear, saying, I know not this man of whom ye speak. And the second time the cock crew, and Peter called to mind the word that Jesus said unto him before the cock crew twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. And when he thought thereon, he wept.
John 21:15-17. So when they had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He saith unto them, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my lambs. He saith to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? He saith unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my sheep. He saith unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, Lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. Jesus saith unto him, Feed my sheep.
Jesus recommissions Peter three times. He's denied him three times. He recommissions him three times in John 21. Restores him three times. You can hear in Peter's response, in his restoration, that he's trying to be very, very careful. He's, in fact, become insistent. Where before he was not only not watchful, he had placed himself in a place of temptation. He didn't really need to be there in that hall. It was idle curiosity to wait around and see what would happen. It brought him into a situation he was simply not prepared to face spiritually, and he denied Christ three times. You know, it was an overactive zeal on his part that brought him there. He certainly thought that he was more spiritually advanced than he was. And it brings him to disgrace, total disgrace. But when Christ, after the resurrection, meets with him again, he's given a chance to reiterate his position. And with each statement, he's not only more adamant, he's more careful, he's more precise about his desire to be obedient. He's become jealous of it now. Because, to a certain extent, he knows now how easy it was for him to fall into that. And this is not the only time Peter's going to suffer from this, but Peter is the waffling apostle. You know, situations arise and Peter goes this way or that way. He bends this way or that way. But in this, we see he's not going to bend this way again. He's not going to deny Christ. You know, he'll bend in other ways, and Paul will have to rebuke him. But in this case, he's been raised to a higher consciousness. He's going to be more watchful. We don't see him going out denying Christ again. In fact, quite the contrary, on the day of Pentecost, he very admirably defends Jesus as the Messiah in what very likely was not an entirely receptive audience. Some of those people, they weren't all there to hear about the Messiah. You know, they were all there for Pentecost, but they weren't all there to get proselytized by an apostle. But Peter doesn't deny him there. He moves forward. He's much more careful after that. And he's been, because God brings out of that, he's permitted him to fall into that sin, that at the end of it all, he will be more circumspect. Right, hence, in the way of discipline, we see that God, for the good of his people, to mortify their sins and to strengthen their graces, does often wisely and graciously, though never finally, for a season and to a degree, withdraws spiritual influences from his own children and leave them to the manifold temptations and corruptions of their own hearts. We'll look at 1 Corinthians 10, 12 and 13.
1 Corinthians 10, verses 12 and 13. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able. But will the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it?
Yeah, we're told that God isn't going to allow any temptation to come that we couldn't have escaped, first of all. So that when we don't escape them, what does that tell us? It tells us that the problem is not God. God already told us He would let us out. We just need to look. The reason we don't escape from them is we don't want to. We want to fall into them because we love sin. We love the occasion of sin. And so God does for a time, in order to discipline us, brings us to that point, lays us low in some sinful situation. But it's never, if we're His children, it will never be totally or finally. It's just going to be for a season and to a degree. It's only going to be in part, not in total. We're not going to totally and finally fall from grace. We're not, if we are God's children, that can't happen. And so the temptations will be such that even when we do fall into them, when we sin, if we're God's children, we will eventually be recovered out of them. Again, this is not an advertisement or an encouragement to sin. Because when you're in it, you don't know whether or not you're going to recover. You have no reason to assume you're a child of God when you're in the midst of it. You should be questioning everything. We will talk about that later in the confession. But this is talking about the providence surrounding all of that. Why God is doing that. And the answer is that He's trying to sift us. He's sifting us. He's sifting us so that in future occasions, in future situations, we will be more watchful. You know, if you've never slipped on ice, you're probably not going to be very careful when you're walking around and it's icy. But if you've ever slipped on ice, especially if you've ever really hurt yourself, you're going to be much more circumspect. Analogously with sin, if you've fallen into a sin and you're a child of God and you've been delivered from it, you're going to be much more circumspect. You're going to avoid. You already know, or you should know if you've reflected, what kinds of situations, what pieces of the puzzle needed to be put next to one another in order for you to find it very convenient to put the last piece or two in so that the sin occurs. Mm-hmm. Having been redeemed out of that, restored from that, it should be enough to make you want to avoid all future occasion. It should make you not only want to avoid it, but it should also help you understand both the depravity of your own heart, your utter dependence on God, and the need to be watchful so that you don't find yourself in those kinds of situations. You know, it's amazing to me how many times I've heard people talk about the stupid things they do when they get drunk. And yet, it never occurs to them that maybe the answer is don't get drunk. Or at least a large part of the answer is don't get drunk. But we're sinners, you see. We don't like being told that we should have self-control, that we should be careful about things. We like to kick around the edge of that abyss and risk falling in. We like to bring ourselves to the brink of total disaster. And then, when there is some horrible consequence, sinful men, say, I don't know why that happened to me, or, you know, I didn't deserve that. Shouldn't have happened. You see, the children of God, when they're brought to these situations and they've been delivered from a sin, not only do they not say, that shouldn't have happened to me, they look at it and say, you know, I didn't get half of what I deserved, A, and B, I need to be more careful. You know, I should believe this promise of God. There is no temptation set before me where there isn't a way out. Well, people used to laugh at the anti-drug message years ago, just say no. But there is something to that. And we don't like to just say no, because we like sin. But if we did simply say no to putting ourselves in these situations, to allowing ourselves to keep that company, to engage in these kinds of activities, we would avoid a world of hurt in this world and the threat of eternal damnation in the world to come. People of God, when they fall into sin, they're known by this, that they recognize God's justness in punishing their iniquity and His grace in delivering them from it. And furthermore, they're going to make good use of it. They're going to make good use of it because they're going to use it as a yardstick to evaluate themselves so that they can take a measure of their own depravity, so that they can recognize their cast down condition before God, that they're utterly dependent upon God. And finally, that they're going to be more watchful or careful about what they do. Not presume. You know, in a battle where you know there's a minefield, people don't generally go skipping through the minefield. They tend to crawl through the minefield with detectors trying to find it. Why aren't they just running through there? Because it would be a disaster. You know, if you've fallen into sin, you should know it's a minefield. It's a disaster waiting to happen. Don't do it again. You should be careful. You should be more watchful, more circumspect. All right, we're going to continue with the doctrine of providence next time.